In the wake of the Kerry Stainer case, we need to address some realities on the use, or more properly, misuse of psychological professionals in the courtroom. American courts rely upon these alleged experts in the field of mental illness, but psychological professionals are no more qualified to judge many points, such as someone's state of mind at the time of a crime, than anyone else. Such experts are called upon to decide what someone's likely to do in the future, but long experience has shown that they're no better than random guessing in making that determination. Psychological experts are called upon to find some diagnosis with which to label someone in order to mitigate his criminal actions. Antisocial and perhaps even murderous behavior is in effect decriminalized by such labels. The guy couldn't help it, you see. He's sick. Experts in the psychological field often assure us of what trauma caused someone to do something afterwards. This is often the sort of post hoc reasoning that would have gotten your high school composition paper red inked. Remember, B coming after A doesn't mean A caused B. Psychological experts tell us what sort of behavior can qualify as a disability. Discrimination lawsuits can follow. Of late, the Kerry Stainer trial provided us with some incredible examples of the inappropriateness of psychiatric testimony, but let's return to that later. It might be good at this point to review the notorious McMartin preschool case to illustrate some points at hand. Now, you may recall the McMartin case in the 1980s. It cost the state of California $15 million. It was, in fact, the most expensive court case in California history. And, of course, you and I, the taxpayer, picked up the tab. It drug on for 7 years. Preliminary hearings alone took 18 months. The McMartin case was a cottage industry for the legal profession. It employed 17 lawyers and 6 judges. It, in fact, ruined many lives, but resulted, thank God, in no convictions. For the entire legal fiasco was a witch hunt. Now, it all began back in 1983. An alcoholic parent of one of the preschool children, who truly was mentally ill, she carried a diagnosis of paranoid schizophrenia, alleged that her son had been molested at the school. It's worth noting that at no point did psychological professionals step in to determine that the tales by this woman did not hold water. Neither did the police and courts. But at least a lack of corroborating evidence meant that the arrested man was not charged. Unfortunately, afterwards, the Manhattan Beach chief of police circulated a letter to parents asking them to question their children about possible abuse at the preschool. A TV station contributed to the hysteria by suggesting that the preschool might somehow be linked to child pornography rings. The kids were asked leading questions by their alarmed parents, and when they obliged their questioners with stories of sexual abuse and animal sacrifices by apparently most of the staff at the preschool, no one seemed able to determine that there was something wrong with these narratives. In fact, the Children's Institute International interviewed the kids and supported their claims. Matters snowballed. Before long, 100 teachers in 8 area schools were accused. Medical exams were conducted on 150 children, and while no physical evidence of abuse was found, on the strength of the stories told, it was concluded that 120 children had been abused. Now, this was a golden opportunity for psychology to demonstrate its competence in determining truth from fancy. Child psychologists were, however, unable to tell the courts that stories of being led down trapdoors into rooms where they were molested and videotaped were not true. Somehow, parents and district attorney alike were unable to determine that the poured concrete floor of the preschool, which showed no evidence of having been cut through, made such stories impossible. Child psychologists were not able to tell the court that tales of repeated animal sacrifices were untrue, even when the children assured their questioners that giraffes were killed and buried on the premises. Somehow the parents and district attorney alike were unable to determine that the paucity of trenches and animal bones at the site negated such stories. Child psychologists were in fact unable to tell the court that stories of being spirited off by hot air balloon for episodes of molestation were imaginary tales elicited by the questioner's technique. It's astonishing in retrospect that psychologists in the case and psychiatrists could not distinguish false tales from reality, especially in light of the fact that any layman would have tended to have doubted such incredibly unlikely stories. But the acceptance, the so-called experts, of these tales invented by small children misled parents and the courts into abandoning all common sense. Although 100 teachers were accused of satanic rituals and or child molestation, only 7 teachers at the McMartin School were eventually indicted. $15 million later, it was clear that the Children's Institute International's experts asked leading questions, virtually guaranteeing to convince kids that they'd experienced sexual abuse. It must again be stressed that such tales included stories of being flushed down toilets and traveling through sewers to places where they were abused, only to be cleaned up and returned to the preschool in time to be picked up by their parents. Now, any sensible person would have dismissed such stories as being made up. But apparently the psychiatric professionals in the case lacked sensible people. Their best psychological techniques failed to prove that these memories were false. The McMartin case was the first of many cases involving multiple perpetrators and multiple victims. In virtually every instance, the affair was a witch hunt. In cases that had a germ of truth, it appears that one perpetrator engaged in abuse. Now, you'd think that, you know, the 1980s was 20 years ago, and we've learned a lot since then, but actually one decade after the McMartin fiasco, a police detective in Wenatchee, Washington, decided that an epidemic of sexual abuse was rife in the town. His questioning of dysfunctional young girls soon had 20 adults in jail. The supposed epidemic in Wenatchee was covered widely, until investigation of the detective's interrogations and pattern of abusive questioning revealed that they simply lacked credibility. The worst part of all this is that real child abuse, a genuine problem, gets lost in the shuffle. Being able to separate truth from fiction would be invaluable in all such cases. Unfortunately, studies have shown that child psychologists are worse than chance in determining whether a child is not telling the truth. To make such determinations, they don't rely upon any special psychological tests, for no such tests exist. They rely instead upon clinical instinct, an entity as varied as the practitioner. One study of the ability of psychologists to test children involved 42 neuropsychologists. Normal children were told to fake bad on the tests. Not one single case of malingering was determined, while 87% of the practitioners specified cortical brain dysfunction. Comparable findings have been made with adolescents and adults. A famous and now classic study by Rosenham in 1974, something you probably heard about if you took a psychology class, had normal volunteers attempting admission to mental hospitals by claiming only that they heard voices, only 3 words, in fact. In every other respect, they behaved normally. All earned admission, and none were ever suspected of malingering by staff, though numerous patients suspected they were journalists or other fakers. At discharge, most were diagnosed as schizophrenia in remission. Now, we don't wish to leave you with the impression that we do not accept mental illness as a legitimate mitigating factor in criminal cases. Sometimes we do. Joining us to discuss such a case is Cosmo Garvin of the Sacramento News and Review.
The story is about a boy who, at age 15, attempted to kill a woman with a knife, a boy who is mentally retarded, who suffers from autism and has been diagnosed with a number of other developmental disabilities, syndromes, mental health problems.
Now, in this case, this is beyond doubt this boy has serious developmental problems, has not been able to make it in conventional schools, etc.
Absolutely beyond doubt. Agreed to by all parties in his case.
All right.
No one has said that he, you know, you have to say that he allegedly did this, but no one disputes that he did this crime. It was a pretty horrific crime, although his victim didn't die.
All right. Tell what exactly went down?
Early in the morning, late at night, sort of in the wee hours of the morning, left a group home that he had been in for a few weeks, was able to leave without being stopped, sort of in the middle of the night, on his way to take a knife from the group home's kitchen drawer and walk to a shopping center in the Natomas area, where at about 5 o'clock in the morning, he identified a woman walking into a Starbucks coffee shop as his victim, quote unquote, mm-hmm. And stabbed her in the back as she left. I should back up and say that apparently this was all brought on by an episode of America's Most Wanted that he watched the night before, that he, quote unquote, perseverated upon over and over again. This sort of program played itself over and over again in his head. And he got the idea that he needed to act it out in order to put an end to that sort of feedback loop that was going on in his head.
Okay. So he takes a knife out of the group home, goes over to Starbucks, spots someone as a prospective victim, and
stabs her in the back. And then, in his way, attempts to stab her again, although a 15-year-old boy with poor motor skills, sort of poor strategizing abilities and coordination, you know, wasn't able to harm her beyond the first sort of initial stab, the first attack.
Right.
So she was able to get into the store. And the police were called. He was arrested and very quickly was swept up into the court system. Sacramento County District Attorneys filed charges against him as an adult in adult court for attempted premeditated murder, a possibility of 15 years to life in state prison.
This is interesting because we've certainly spent some time on this show bashing the inappropriateness, perhaps, of some various diagnoses and methods of the court in dealing with it. But this seems to be a clear-cut case where the boy obviously can't be held accountable to the same standards of adults, particularly. And you don't want to be, if you're a kid, you got an option of being in juvenile court versus adult court. You know, they tend to be much more lenient.
Right. I think that's the question. Should someone of this age with these disabilities, that no one disputes he has them, no one that I know of disputes he has them, should someone at that age with that suite of disabilities be held accountable as an adult, as voters decided all 15, 16-year-olds should be under the provisions of Prop 21, which was passed by voters a couple of years ago? I don't think that I don't think anybody thought this far ahead. I don't think anybody thought when they passed Prop 21, gosh, is this also going to apply to juveniles with severe mental disabilities or not? We didn't think about that. We thought it's going to apply to all juveniles of a certain age that commit certain serious crimes. I think that people had in mind this sort of predatory gang member, quite sophisticated, violent, antisocial sort of individual who was, for all intents and purposes, not a kid.
I mean, is this really the wave of the future? I mean, are we going to see, is this going to be the kind of case we're going to see everywhere in the state of California?
I think it's inevitable that there will be more cases. You know, when the three strikes law was passed a couple of years before this, these kinds of cases started to pop up that became sort of infamous cases. The cookie thief, the bicycle thief that got put away for life.
Right.
Because stealing cookies or a slice of pizza became their third strike. I think you're going to see more cases like the Maggie case, the boy in this story, pop up, and people are going to rethink and revisit what they intended to do with this law.
My understanding on three strikes is it took a lot of the discretion, I guess, away from district attorneys.
As far as district attorneys and Proposition 21 go, the district attorneys for the past 10 years up until Prop 21 have always had the option of filing on just about any juvenile of a certain age in adult court.
Okay.
But there was another step that had to be gone to. A juvenile court judge would hold a fitness hearing, and the judge would decide, yes, this individual should be in the adult system. No, this one should not. This one can be rehabilitated. This one needs to be flat out punished. Mm-hmm. Prop 21 took the juvenile court system out of the equation and gave DAs the power to directly file, quote unquote, to file charges in adult court without any review.
Well, this kid, for your history here, has got he's been in a group home. He's had some trouble. He's not been mainstreamed out in school, etc. But he's not the sort of, you know, career criminal or budding future career criminal who's out making a life of crime with other gang members at age 16. What's with the DA? I mean, why is he pursuing this?
The way it plays out in Sacramento County, and it's probably like this in any number of counties, the district attorney here has a sort of group of crimes that are serious crimes. I think it's homicide, attempted homicide, a felony with a firearm, and other violent felonies like sexual assault and rape, that the policy is automatically, no matter who you are, you're going to be filed on in adult court. And any lesser crimes than that, the district attorney will look at it and sort of weigh whether or not the juvenile should enter the adult court. So for this class of crimes, it's automatic. So even though this kid is very different individually from other kids who might commit this kind of crime, it's the class of the crime that determined his fate in this case.
So things like drug offenses do not get you necessarily bumped into adult court if you're 16.
Not necessarily. Possibly.
But as I understand it, Cosmo, it's really the same issue involved on really competence. Is this individual competent? You have to make that same call whether you're dealing with a juvenile in juvenile court or whether an adult court. We recognize that some people are not competent to be judged as others, and a judge has to make that call either way.
Right. I think what you said about the individual's competence is important here when you're talking about juvenile justice versus the adult court system. The adult court system, DAs will tell you this, the adult court system is about punishment and deterrence. The juvenile court system is about the individual person and whether that person can be, quote unquote, rehabilitated or helped. To have a whole class of crimes automatically land you in the adult court system, I think, ignores the individual's sort of circumstances, competency.
Right.
Mental health.
So it's much more likely by being an adult court, it'll be dealt with a straight punishment issue as a what do we do with this messed up kid?
Absolutely. If you're in the adult court system and you end up being tried and sentenced as an adult, your chances of getting any sort of mental health services are next to nil. Your chances of being victimized are almost certain.
Yeah.
And although the juvenile court system, you could argue, is not ideal in terms of mental health services or safety, it's got to be better.
That was Cosmo Garvin of the Sacramento News and Review, a fine paper for which Cosmo does some excellent reporting. We recommend it highly. We've got to take a short break, but we will continue our discussion on psychiatry and the courtroom after that break. Stay tuned. You're listening to Radio Parallax on KDVS 90.3 FM.